Ho, 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 ho! Merry Christmas!
From Duforstrasse 90 here in Zurich. This is the Stack 30 Minutes of Print Industry Analysis. I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Georgina Godwin. The Stack this week, as you've heard, is based in Zurich. We're going to be joined by Ralph Atkins, the Austria and Switzerland correspondent for the FT, to see what's making the papers today.
And we'll also look at a new Swiss title called Trip, all about travel and food. Plus, we welcome back Chandra Kurt to discuss print and wine, of course.
But first, Ralph is here and enjoying the Christmas market, as are you, Tyler.
I am Georgina, and very nice to see you back. It's two Christmas weekends on the hop, and it's it was 2 weeks ago that we were in Zurich as well.
Absolutely, you can't keep me away. I have to say, this city absolutely grows on one.
Good. Well, you could get very comfortable in that standing or sitting position.
Well,
from time
to
time.
It's really exciting. So we're doing this show standing up, which is not our normal position. Actually, it gives you, I mean, psychologists always say to feel really powerful, if you have to make a difficult phone call or something, you should stand. And I'm not saying this is a particularly difficult
thing. I was going to say, I hope it's not too arduous a show. I mean, it's the wine hasn't been cracked open yet. But I think we're only about an hour away from that, which is good.
Thank heavens.
You've been chatting a little bit throughout the morning about the market. I mean, last weekend was, I think we were sort of 50 or 60% up last year on London, which was incredible and also a great initiative as well, because a major proceeds taken for the Committee to Protect Journalists as well, which is the charity that we're supporting.
Mm-hmm. And here in Zurich, not as big as London, but still really, really exciting people. Lots of beautifully handmade things made in Italy, things made here in Switzerland, lots of cashmere. There's a lot of merino wool, some porcelain, really gorgeous stuff, and some great subscriber offers too.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot today about Made in Switzerland and Brand Switzerland in general. And maybe on that note, we should say good morning and welcome to Ralph Atkins from the Financial Times.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here. It's nice to talk about Christmas markets instead of stock markets.
Well, exactly. I mean, we can, which I think is a bit of an industry in itself. I know that there was a bit of a land grab recently because the gentleman who runs the Christmas market on the Sechseleutenplatz, quite controversial, but he just won the gig, which he's running now, the Christmas market in Geneva. I've always sort of thought, though, it's quite an interesting business, because you see these gentlemen running it, and there's and this is Switzerland, so it's still a land of cash as well, and there's always like big bricks of money, of course, when they take the proceeds at the end of the day.
I'm a bit of a Christmas market snob, because before I came to Switzerland, I lived for 8 years in Frankfurt in Germany, which I regard as the home of the Christmas market, and I think anything else, they're slight imposters, I think, when it comes to Christmas market in Swiss.
But not the Monaco Christmas market.
Oh, of course not.
Well, hopefully not. We've got. We're going to start off looking at the papers. You've got your fine journal. I see sort of cracked open there. I'm not sure, and I didn't get to see the Financial Times yet this morning. But it was a bit of an interesting day between Brussels and Bern yesterday, I believe. And you must have been probably busy later into the afternoon or early evening.
We were busy. Yes. Well, it was quite an amazing news day all round across Europe yesterday. In fact, with Brexit in the UK, we have the yellow vests in France. We have the new leadership in Germany, and amongst all that, there's this slightly epic, long-running battle going on between Brussels and Bern over their institutional relationship. And it's a game of who blinks first. And very effectively, perhaps naughtily, maybe not in their long-term interest, the Swiss have thrown the ball back into the Brussels court, saying we're not going to agree or disagree with this. Come on, make our day. You know, are you going to take any sanctions against us, basically?
And just, can you frame it for our listeners who might be, at least sort of standing around the barbecue in New Zealand at this hour? What's at the core of this story if you're not sort of at the centre of European politics every day?
Well, I suppose very briefly, Switzerland is not a member of the EU, although it's surrounded entirely by EU members. So it has to have a sort of relationship with them, a trading relationship. It's a very successful economy based on largely with trading with Switzerland. But how do you have that relationship as a third-party country if you're not actually a member. I think for decades, Switzerland got away with a very favourable deal because Switzerland's small and very nice and lovely. Then came Brexit, and the EU started to think, yikes, we need to get relationships with third countries on a proper, consistent basis. So they've been turning the screws on Switzerland and saying, if you're going to have the benefits of links, you need to agree, for instance, to have rules that change in line with ours. You need to have a role for the European Court of Justice. You need to have accept our directives on the rights of EU citizens and so on. And that's all very sensitive in Switzerland.
Oh, and in Britain too. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening with Brexit to see that easy solutions aren't going to be forthcoming.
There are a lot of parallels, yes. I mean, for instance, yesterday, Brussels was saying, well, this is our offer, this is our final offer, we're not going to renegotiate it. Precisely what they said to the UK. But the Swiss say, oh, hang on, could we just have another look at this bit again? You know, maybe we could just renegotiate that bit. It's a very familiar game.
We've got lessons to learn, haven't we, in Britain?
Yeah.
On diplomacy.
Yeah, they're very different countries, and of course Switzerland's never joined, whereas the UK is trying to leave, so they're different starting positions, but there are, as I say, a lot of parallels.
Ralph, here's one for you. Do you think that we would be in the position that we're in the UK? Because, as you said, Switzerland is, of course, outside the EU, but they're part of Schengen. And I always sort of think, you know, it would be kind if the UK holidaymaker was within Schengen, they would definitely sort of vote to stay in the EU, because there is something actually about being, you know, in this country, just jumping on a plane still to Berlin, and you don't have to show your passport, and away you go. You really sort of see the benefits, at least of friction-free borderless travel.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you visit Switzerland from anywhere from the EU, you would hardly notice that you've left the EU. When you're here, you notice things like taxes and customs and so on, but basically when you're travelling around, you don't notice. I think you're right, for a lot of Brits, if we're in Schengen, it would be seen as another big advantage. But then there are worries about terrorism. And then I think also it doesn't address that sort of deep-seated fear in the UK about free movement of people that reflected in that massive vote for Brexit back in 2016.
What else is catching your eye in the FT?
In the FT, OPEC, the battles over the oil price, all very politically sensitive, the role of Saudi Arabia. In fact, that was our lead story this morning. And of course, the endless revelations and twists and turns in the whole Russian inquiry in the US and the Mueller inquiry. And so those would be the main headlines dominating. In fact, dominating the Swiss press as well as the non-Swiss press, even despite Switzerland's own internal battles.
The Mueller probe is so interesting. I mean, it's just taken a big turn, hasn't it, with Michael Cohen looking at really spending some significant time inside.
Yes. I mean, watching it from afar, you sort of constantly shocked or worried about each step of the revelations, but whether it sort of ultimately changes the course of direction of US politics, I think from sitting here, it doesn't seem to have any effect at all.
Oh, just jumping back to OPEC for a second, because you look after this country and the other one on the other side of the border, Austria.
Liechtenstein, you mean.
And Liechtenstein as well. Is OPEC part of your patch?
No, I wasn't there. We do have colleagues who are experts at joining in the press jostles and the fights that go on, to the scrambles to try and get hold of all the oil ministers, but we had a team of people who devote their entire life to following these people around the world on the oil prices. But I do Austria as a country, not the institutions.
So as Tyler was saying, OPEC, the Qatar developments are interesting. What's happening there?
Qatar leaving OPEC, you mean? Yeah, well, it's a real balance of shift of power, isn't it? Because then also you have Russia aligning itself with OPEC as well. And this all fits in, everything converges, doesn't it? Because it all links up to the standoff with the US and Trump, and Trump's determination to try and push oil prices down and to recast his relationship with Russia, recast the US relationship with Russia and Russia at the same time, linking up on the whole oil price thing. So, yeah.
I just want to ask you, because this particular program deals with the world of journalism, part of it print and otherwise. And what's it like covering the Swiss patch? Because we see a lot of datelines and a lot of international news organizations choose to cover this country from Geneva, and that makes sense on one side, obviously, if WTO and other UN agencies and NGOs are part of your patch. And then there's obviously Zurich, and maybe one or two people base themselves in Bern as well. Is it a lot of time spent on SBB shuttling back between Geneva and Zurich, or does this sort of make sense as a news gathering hub for you?
You don't spend too much time, never spend too much time on an SBB train because they go so fast and so efficient between, unfortunately, you can't stay too long on that. I think the maximum you can spend is 3 hours if you go all the way from one end of the country to the other, but it's worth doing it, so I've done it. For the Financial Times, maybe the choice is made easier because we are obviously care an awful lot about the big Swiss companies, and the big Swiss banks are based here in Zurich, so it makes a lot of sense to be based here in Zurich. Geneva, I think there's sort of the way journalism's changed. I think people cover the Geneva institutions from around the world, frankly. We don't have anyone in Geneva anymore. If we want to cover the UN or the WTA, the relevant specialists can cover it from wherever, and also when it comes to peace talks. So in fact, I've spent little time in Geneva on international affairs. Geneva remains, of course, an important financial centre. So I go backwards a lot between Bern and also Basel as well, of course, with the big pharma companies as well, which is... quite a hub.
Okay. One thing that we've touched on with Georgina as well is that this is this country in many ways is a bit of a bubble, both good and bad. When you look at the Swiss media, do you feel given the size of the country, scraping 9 million people, that there may be in a bit of a unique position? There's some rather sort of luxurious problems that some of the Swiss media have. Now, of course, they moan about it, and they're quite good at that here from time to time as well. But do you think this also is quite an interesting media market to look at when you look at the NZZ, the state of a player like Time Media, or even a small player down the street like Ringier, their inroads into Africa, for example, is actually quite small players but doing rather interesting things.
They like all media, like us as well. I mean, they have to address this whole sort of revolution and the shift towards online. But they have the advantage that they have quite a conservative readership. If you wander around Zurich, if you get a chance later on, you'll see people sitting in all the cafes reading all the papers, proper old-fashioned print newspapers like we have here. And I think that'll stay for some time. I think there's a very strong newspaper reading tradition which will help them. I think there's sort of the challenge is that it's a small domestic market. So how do you build beyond that? And I think the sort of challenge for a brand like the NZZ is to make themselves into sort of more of a sort of global German language market leader. They face competition. You have the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and Die Zeit as well, which we have here as well.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, we'll be looking at all of those papers in just a moment. I think we'll take a break.
You're listening to The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Georgina Godwin. Our guest in the studio is Ralph Atkins from the Financial Times.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, Ralph. Now, we were having a look through the FT, your own paper, before the break, and we're back now. We've said that we'll be looking at some of the local papers, also the New York Times. Now, we've been leading in our headlines about what's happening in Paris. No major violence yet, though I think they are expecting it. There are just thousands and thousands of security forces on the street. It's a very rocky time for Macron, isn't it, as the New York Times reports?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this morning, the headline, and it's a piece by Sylvie Kaufmann, it says, "A moment of reckoning for Macron. He was the savior of Europe, a 39-year-old maverick who rescued France from populist tide, the newcomer who crushed his far-right opponent, Marie Le Pen, in a TV debate on the eve of a presidential election." And of course, on it goes to really talk about also what we're watching on our screens right now, seeing what is going to potentially erupt in Paris today. Or not. Certainly a lot of security forces. When you look across the border, the other direction, Ralph, this country's relationship with France is also always a bit of a curious one. There were quite some significant protests and arrests just on the other side of the border towards Mulhouse yesterday. Looking at from this side, what happens within the Élysée Palace, and where does Monsieur Macron have to move at the moment?
I think he's, as the New York Times says, it's a moment of reckoning for him, isn't it? I think it's sort of a slight delayed eruption of populism in France we've seen. I mean, I think we focus for too long on the rise of the Front National and Marine Le Pen and so on. Maybe now what we're seeing is more of a grassroots movement and more akin to the Brexit movement as well. I think the options for him are quite limited. I mean, he's sort of set himself against doing a U-turn. Well, he did set himself against doing any U-turn, but he has U-turned this week. His options are fairly limited. I mean, I think maybe he has to try and be more of a conciliator and more of a unifier within his country, which is obviously not going to be easy. It's striking this happens at the same time as we've got the change of leadership in Germany, as you mentioned. I mean, in Germany, what we've seen is with the election of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer.
Yes.
Let's just call her AKK from now on, because she represents continuity. But of course, in Germany, you do have those sort of shifting forces as well of tribal politics and people moving away from the mainstream parties. So perhaps France is a warning for future.
But of course, I mean, Macron has been positioning himself for this moment. When Merkel goes, Macron definitely wants to be the leader of Europe, doesn't he? And I mean, as we're going to be discussing in the Foreign Desk in a short while, we'll be looking at the whole that sort of united force of Europe, which he's really pushing for. Is this the end of his European dream?
I don't know. I mean, he's how long is he into office now? A couple of years, less. It seems that great leaders do go through their moments, don't they? I always remember Mrs. Thatcher, 2 years after her election in 79, the early 80s, when we had sort of huge protests against disruption, economic... great economic time and troubles and worries and fears and lack of confidence, and she was saved in the end by the Falklands War. I mean, let's hope we don't have anything like this in France's case. But I think sort of leaders go through that process, don't they? And maybe they emerge stronger from these processes. But it's a learning curve. They're all on a learning curve, like all of us.
I just saw a little bit earlier. You had the front page of Die Zeit was there. They've got a cover story, and you were mentioning Swiss trains, and they're having a bit of a go at Deutsche Bahn. It looks like.
I used to live in Germany for a long time, and the highlights of my being a journalist in Germany was taking the train and going into the dining car of the Deutsche Bahn and drinking the. It was just a very good cheese selection actually in the dining car. I don't know. But what's happened since I've left to the trains? They seem to have gone. Can trains go downhill? I think they probably
can.
They can, which rapidly, too rapidly, perhaps. And it's interesting because I think the German trains were seen as a model, and I think this is another area where Switzerland is sort of preserving that sort of world leadership, because I think Swiss trains still are very efficient. And I think the key problem in Germany has been this sort of lack of infrastructure investment, which is a general theme. And I think that there's a bit of recognition now in Germany now that actually, they'd be running massive budget surpluses, but they fail to invest in the infrastructure, and that their economic model is in danger. And I think Deutsche Bahn is very much a symptom of that. So.
But again, I think this is, you felt it had a leadership position. I mean, I still get on ICE3 in Germany and feel pretty good about things. I love the cheese platter. I like the cheese in Wurst platter as well. And that you still get seat-side service. It's very spacious. I mean, and of course, compared to the trains in a country where a lot of us spend a lot of time in the UK. And then you talk about infrastructure. I mean, at least you still see them building high-speed lines in Germany.
They don't still have the semaphore signals in Germany.
Exactly.
But of course, we've had this big rail story in Britain where the head of Crossrail and HS2 has had to step down.
Yes. I know, that was a bit of a... because Crossrail was sort of the hope that actually we might finally get a bit of transport infrastructure we could be proud of, and anyone in London, I think, I live on the southeast side, and getting to Heathrow is a day's trip, and Crossrail will transform my life. But so I can't wait for it to open. But
and it's one of those funny stories too, that it really sort of, I guess, people were sort of hoping, or someone was really sort of sitting on this delay, and it was supposed to be open by now, and they say, I guess, we're probably a year out from it happening, and let's hope it doesn't turn into a Berlin airport story.
Yeah,
but you sort of wonder how they were able to keep a lid on it for quite so long. Was there anything else though in detail other than the trains that you wanted to...
Die Zeit is a wonderful, very heavy, serious newspaper, and I'd only got to the front page.
It's one of those titles for people who aren't familiar. We reference it a lot.
You have a week to read it. Actually.
You do, and I think this is interesting. It's a great model. I have to say we're slightly copying it with our winter and summer weeklies, and I think this idea of bringing out a kind of what is positioned as a weekend paper, that it comes out on a Thursday, and you probably, people are not reading it right away, but it's something, as you said, that it's definitely a day's worth of reading if it drifts into Saturday and Sunday, so be it. And also an outstanding supplement as well. I just think it's world-class or supplement.
It's very good. You might find myself walking off with your design.
That's right. No one's going to stop you at the door.
I think there's time for a quick look at the NZZ.
The NZZ, yes. The NZZ, as I mentioned before we have CDU leadership on the front page, but dominated as they often do on a Saturday with an opinion piece, basically arguing that in the negotiations with Ben they lack vision and leadership. Which actually I've seen similar things in some of the other Swiss press this morning, the slight sort of feeling that there's a slight sort of sense of lost heads in Bern and need a sort of sense of direction, and that but of course, as I said, this whole question about how they relate in future with the EU is deeply divisive in Switzerland, like it is in the UK, and trying to find a compromise is going to be very difficult.
And just before we go, it's just such a classic NZZ cover, all black and white. There's barely a splash of color.
No pictures.
I mean, no. You know, from a contemporary newspaper publishing point of view, it breaks every rule. And yet it's very honest and true to what it is as a brand.
Yes, it's comforting, it's reliable. It signifies stability, reliability. That's what you need in journalism.
That's what we want. And I think it's interesting, as you said earlier, it will be interesting to see under they have a new CEO at the newspaper, and whether they
put pictures on the front page.
Yeah, and really go for it. And as you said, I think that their opportunity is, it's a very respected paper, whether they go for becoming a bit more of a global paper of record, and whether they, I've heard, whether they also go for English as well, which will be interesting.
That's always been a bad move for German papers, I think. German journalism just doesn't translate.
No. Well, maybe there's an opportunity for could be a former FT correspondent to work for the NZZ. You never know.
Ralph, we're going to watch your career with interest.
I'll put you down on my list of referees.
Thank you very much to Ralph Atkins. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be meeting the team from Trip magazine.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Zurich this morning with me, Tyler Brulé.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Lovely smells.
I know, lovely smells. There's the sort of the rather sort of pungent and welcoming smell of the raclette outside. You can certainly smell the glühwein and just a sort of a general sort of scent of nice sort of pininess here as well.
It smells Christmassy.
It does smell very Christmassy. And I can hear a lot of buzz outside. I can't quite see around the corner of our setup here, but certainly plenty of people outside, indoors, here at a Christmas market. If you're listening and you're somewhere in the Zurich region, we're here until 1900 today, and we'll be here all day tomorrow as well. And it's Georgina. We had a very lovely last weekend with Santa. There's no Santa. There's no reindeer. But maybe I guess in this market, you don't have to try quite as hard as we do in London.
No, and also the reindeer are really busy now. I mean, we could talk to them in London. But now that the workload's really ramped up.
Indeed it has. Now, on Thursday evening, we hosted a very nice Christmas apéro here, and there was a very excitable young gentleman who's across the table from us at the moment. And he thrust a very nice new magazine in the hands of my hands, but also that of our other editors as well. It's called Trip, Travel, Cook, and Eat with Ralph Schelling. And I'm happy to say that Ralph is here. He's also joined by Sylvain Muller, photographer who's worked on this project as well. And gentlemen, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ralph, maybe we should start. Tell us a little bit about the idea. And of course, we should say you're not a journalist by training. You are a chef. You've spent a lot of time working with some of the most respected chefs elsewhere in Europe, but what was the idea of deciding that you wanted to don a wetsuit and jump off the coast of Caracas?
Yeah, so it was like the idea was like, so I worked many years in like high class restaurants, and I worked since about 2 or 3 years. I work as a private chef and do things like this. And I was a bit sick from doing always this cucumber foams and beetroot jelly cubes. And I want
Man
to
after my own heart.
and I want to do like what I like. And I guess Sylvain too, the photographer, and on Trip we travel where we want to go, and we don't go to Barcelona and see these fancy places where everyone goes. So we went to the restaurant where Ferran Adrià loves to eat. So we, this is just a very easy fish restaurant, but very delicious, and we went there and we love it, and that's what we want to share now on our magazine.
And so the magazine is basically a culinary diary, a travel guide, and a beautifully designed cookery magazine all in one.
Right, yeah.
And it follows your travels around the world.
Yes. And yeah, the first trip is in Cadaqués, where Silvan has a small vineyard there. And of course, I work and live there when I worked at El Buibi in 2009. And so that was one of the reasons to go back to this beautiful place. And that's what we have here now.
Tyler's just leafing through it at the moment. It's a very beautiful book, isn't it?
It is. And it takes you on a journey, certainly on, well, we don't just stay in this stretch of Spain. We also venture further afield. But what it does, though, it's incredibly personal. So then just tell us, from a photographic point of view, it's interesting to, of course, team up and then also, I think, sort of deliver something quite singular. I think I always say, with, you know, the great thing about, you know, good magazines, when you launch a magazine, you have to have a clarity of vision, and you certainly see that in this.
To be honest, it was quite easy in that case, because my publisher asked me to do a book actually with Ralph, and but Ralph is one of those young, obsessive, hyperactive kids who should get some medication, some serious medication. So, but instead of that, we decided to do the magazine, which fit quite well. So, if you're on a journey with Ralph, it creates situations which are that personal that it's not that hard to get personal stories, and if you're on the road with him, so.
You sound a little bit exhausted, though. So I'm already sort of wondering whether Sylvain, you're signed up for issue two or not.
What I really love about this is that you are disrupting the standard magazine format. All the stories have room to breathe, don't they? They're slightly longer format. Yeah. Tell us about the decision behind that and how you came to just deciding how this would all play out.
You know, as I'm coming from working on books, actually, and as we decided to work slowly and precisely, we also decided to come up just once a year, which gives you a totally other opportunity to do a magazine, because it can be closer to book than to a magazine. And you know, we don't want to explain everything at all. We also leave the stories quite open, and we don't have to explain where to go, where to eat, where to stay. It's just about stories, and it's about culinary obsession of a region. It has to get as personal as possible, not even with Ralph, but especially with our protagonist.
Ralph, tell me, you started off by saying that you're a little bit fatigued with cucumber foam and beetroot jelly cubes, and I couldn't agree more. Do you feel that, and I think Switzerland is an interesting market, because, you know, on one side, Switzerland is known for, you know, very cozy cuisine, you know, geschnetzels and schnitzels and, you know, lots of kartoffeln. As I said, you know, you've got raclette outside. Yeah. But there's another side of Swiss cuisine as well, which seems, I don't mean this in a rude way, but it's just an observation, a little bit caught in time, a little bit too schnick-schnack, a little bit too overdone, everyone, you know, looking for a Michelin star. And did you want to maybe also correct that and sort of remind people about the honesty of food as well?
Yeah, and it was like, I mean, years ago, I want to have a restaurant like this too. I want to get a Michelin star, I want to have a restaurant and doing the things. But I think at the end, people like good food, they like to eat delicious food. And for example, when we had the lounge last week here in Zurich, so we did fideuà. The recipe is also in the book, and it's a type of paella from Catalonia, but with short pasta. And everyone, I don't know, everyone don't like this dish because it's delicious. It's with smoked, with this pimenton de la Vera, this smoked paprika. And I think also the guys from the UK, they love that much better than a real paella, because it's with pasta and that's what everyone like.
I mean, I love the way that at the end of that, we then have the recipe from you. And we also have your tips, Ralph's tips. Yeah. And it tells us what to do. So for instance, stop stirring once the liquid's been added. All the way through through this wonderful piece. We have all of these bits of advice and all the recipes coming in, beautifully printed here in Switzerland, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. We printed it all in here.
Tell me a little bit more about these recipes, because at the end there's a big section, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, at the end we have like some typical Catalonian dish, but with a bit of my inspiration in it. But there is also quite very, very simple recipe. One of my favorite dish is just a easy tortilla, and that's what we eat every Sunday after working at El Bui. So we went out for a party, and then at the next day we call it hangover breakfast here in the magazine. It's just eggs, because usually a tortilla is like with fried potatoes, because you know the Spanish people, they fry everything. So what we do, and it's quite easy and simple and delicious, we just put crisps. A bit of crisps in, mix it with the eggs, and put it in a pan, and it's one of the best tortilla I ever had. And it's there are just two ingredients, and because the salt is also, it's already on the crisps, so just mix that and put it in a pan, and you have a delicious, easy tortilla.
What are you doing tomorrow morning?
Yeah, I think we needed you the weekend before last. That would have been absolutely right.
But it's Saturday night in Zurich.
It is Saturday night in Zurich. Anything could happen. So but tell me, just going into this, and I think probably lots of our listeners are already sort of thinking, where is Sylvain's vineyard, and how can I sort of get there? So who introduced who to the region?
I have a totally different approach to the region than Ralph. He was cooking at El Bui, which is just around the corner from Caracas, and I was introduced to the region by my brother, who owns a little land in Caracas, and I started to build up that little vineyard with my brother. So, but as we tried to do it as simple as possible for the first issue, we decided to go to a region which we know both. And then, which is the most important thing about that magazine, we decided to go to a region during a season where you don't go. Nobody goes to Caracas during winter, but the culinary treasures, they are to find during wintertime. Galchots, you can find all those sea urchins, and all those feasts about eating and food and drinking. San Sebastian, which is a very important feast in Caracas, or the arriving of the Three Kings, and all that stuff. So it was obvious to decide to do that magazine during wintertime, then nobody's there. And the charm of Caracas, you probably find in winter, not in summer, when it's very crowded.
And I'm fascinated because in a moment we're going to be joined by Chandra Kurt, who has become a bit of a doyen of the world of Swiss wine, and also with publishing. But tell us, what are you producing, and what kind of volumes, or is it only for personal consumption? He asks selfishly.
Legally and officially, it's just for personal consumption.
But as everything's a secret around the microphones.
No, it's around 1,000 bottles a year. So. Okay. It's just a tiny,
very personal
year.
Consumption.
And where can we buy this wonderful magazine, Trip?
You can buy it on our website, www.trip-magazine.ch. Or hopefully as soon as possible at your shop.
I'm sure we've got supplies. Hopefully, Ralph, you brought us a box. Hopefully.
Of course.
Of course.
Brilliant. Ralph and Sylvain, thank you so much. Ralph Schelling and Sylvain Muller, and the magazine is Trip, Travel, Cook and Eat with Ralph Schelling, and it's out now. This is The Stack on Monocle 24, coming to you live from our Zurich bureau, where our Christmas market is going strong. Now, we've just been speaking to a couple of really, really interesting guests here in the studio. They are Ralph Schelling and Sylvain Muller, and they were talking to us about their magazine Trip. And Tyler, in fact, is at this very moment.
There's a photo shoot going on around me, but that is complete. And yes, if our listeners want to get a copy, as they said, you can find it at trip-magazine.ch. We'll also have it, I'm sure, at the Kiosk Cafe in London quite soon, but we'll also have it here at Dufour Strasse 90.
Now, I think that Trip might be at the top of my Christmas list in terms of what I want for Christmas as far as print goes. What would be at the top of your list?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's a couple of things. We talked about this magazine a couple of weeks ago. I like this new magazine from France called L'Etiquette. Really a beautiful new men's magazine, just full of great wearable clothes. I think it's very much in our orbit in terms of the things that I believe our readers and I would certainly like in my wardrobe. Every time I introduce people to Casa Brutus, again, it's a title we talk about a lot, but I think Casa Brutus from Japan, even if you don't read Japanese, it's just such a feast, and it does what a good magazine does. It takes you somewhere. It knows exactly who it is and what it wants to be as a magazine. And it's always that sort of interesting friction, Georgina, between, yeah, you surprise people. Why do I go back to a magazine month after month? So I go there because there's something stable and there's things I like. But it also tempts me back because it has to surprise me. Mm. And I always think that's difficult because some magazines, you know, tip too far in the other direction. There's too much reinvention. They're always redesigning themselves. You're like, where am I from a navigation point of view, etc. And then some titles too are just maybe sort of too stuck in their grid and too locked into their art direction.
Let's find out what the rest of the team want for Christmas this year when it comes to print.
I'm Ben Ryland, producer and presenter at Monocle 24. For Christmas this year, I'd really like a subscription to Vanity Fair magazine. I've been buying it pretty much every month for quite a while now. I don't know why I haven't already subscribed. Hint, hint. I think the redesign that we saw just recently was such a success. The cover that we saw towards the end of the year with Lin-Manuel Miranda, very, very impressive. So I'd love to sink my teeth into that magazine a little bit more. But also, I'd like a subscription to The Age newspaper in my hometown of Melbourne. It's been tough times for them recently. They've just been taken over by another company. The old Fairfax Media brand has now been retired, or will be very, very soon. So there's a lot of uncertainty floating across the editorial floor over there in Melbourne. It is still a very, very impressive newspaper, and I'd love to be able to read it a little bit more often now that I'm living on the other side of the world.
I'm Carlotta Rubel and I'm a producer for Monocle 24. This year for Christmas, I would like a subscription to Anxi Mag. They're doing fantastic work in raising awareness to mental health, which is something that impacts all of us. And I would also like for the media industry to sort out the pay gap.
Hello, it's me, Markus Hippi. What I really want this Christmas is a subscription for the German food magazine Beef and also the Nordic baking book by the Swedish top chef Magnus Nilsson. The Beef magazine I find interesting because, simply put, it's a food magazine for men. Yes, there are a lot of images of steaks and sausages on its pages, but also less cliched articles on food and drink. Just don't expect for too many vegan or vegetarian recipes on those pages, though. And the Nordic baking book is a good idea, as I am Nordic and I've really never baked before. Maybe starting that would be a good New Year's resolution for 2019. And actually, if I'm going to be baking and eating sausages in 2019, I should probably get something to motivate me to exercise too. So if I'm allowed, I'd like to make a third wish for my Christmas presents list, and that would be a subscription of Men's Health. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Edwards from Monocle 24. I was going to do an advent calendar of print, but given we're already well underway with the festive season, I thought I'd do a quickfire A to Z of what I'd like to find under the tree. A is for Appartamento, B is for Benji Newman, C, Casa Brutus, D for Dot, E for I, F for Four and Sons, G for Good Trouble, H is for Howler, I is for Interview, J is for Journal du Thé, K is for Kinfolk, L is for Lindsay, M is for Migrant Journal, N for The New Yorker, of course, O for Observador, P for Private Eye, Q for Quest, R for Racket, S for Skirt Chronicles, T for The California Sunday Magazine, U is for the U in AU, V is for Vogue's, W is weeklies, particularly those from Monocle, and X is for Espresso. I know it starts with an E, but X. Y is for Yes or No, and Z is for Zeit magazine, their extra editions, be they the international one or the city specials. On that last point, roll on the London one.
Dear Santa, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco, the producer of The Stack. I might be a bit greedy this year and I want three things, if possible, of course. First, I would like a nice bunch of note cards from paper makers Gemund. They always do lovely ones. I remember they had one with a little bird, a pineapple, among other things. I'm very curious to see their 2019 collection for note cards. Also, I would like a home delivery of the best newspapers in the world, according to me, which is, I love my Brazilian paper Folha de São Paulo, Le Monde, Die Zeit, and please, please, don't forget the supplements. They are kind of essential. And finally, I promise this is the last thing. I'm quite interested in fashion and I want to see all the spring-summer trends, so I would like those magazines that they're kind of massive catalogs showing all the lookbooks from my favorite collections. It can be either Gap Press Man from Japan or Show Details from Italy. You know, it's up to you. Thank you, Santa, and Merry Christmas.
Some of the Monocle 24 team's Christmas wishes. Georgina, I didn't ask you though. What would you like if you could have a subscription or two, something, a daily to come through front door, a weekly, a monthly? What would it be?
Oh, I think it's always the Pony Club magazine for me.
Pony Club. Must be, yes. And that was a little bit of a story which we can spend more time around the table at a later date. But aside from the Pony Club quarterly, what else would it be?
You know, that there is so much choice out there, and I've been so struck by, as you were saying, the changing face of magazines, particularly women's magazines, and the focus away now from perfect bodies and all the rest of it. The fact that there is much more talk about what's going on in our heads rather than what we look like, and I found that very interesting just to track it. I have a wonderful selection of Just 17 magazines from my older sister, who was 16 years older than me. So these are very, very old magazines. And that's absolutely fascinating, looking at what teenagers wanted in the 50s, basically. I cherish them. I go back and look at them all of the time. And the adverts are just so beautiful. And so I think I'd actually like to go back in time and have a subscription to 17 of 1955.
I think that's interesting. on Just 17, a little bit of trivia for you. If you go back and look at, I think probably late 1989 or early 1990, you might find me in Just 17.
Really?
Yeah.
What, modeling?
Not modeling, but when I was launching my career with the BBC.
How fantastic. Yeah. I can swap you a secret for that.
Okay.
If you go to Blue Jeans magazine, which was the True Romance, you know, the strip photographs, and you have lots of pictures of me going, I wonder if he likes me. And then in the next thing, there's like, oh, perhaps we'll go on a date. And it was such fun to do. When you're a student, as you know, any bit of money is helpful.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Stack. We're just going away for a very, very short break. Chandra Curtis here next.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24 today, coming to you live from our Zurich bureau, where our Christmas market is going strong.
And there's indeed lots to eat and drink, including some excellent wine out front. Of course, on that topic of food and drink, we have Chandra Kurt here in studio with us. You were with us last week in London, part manning the Swiss raclette and wine table. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good to see you. And we have some first proofs here next week. It's number 13. It's edition 13 already, Chandra, of the Wine Cellar Journal, which is going to be hitting people's letterboxes and tables just in time for Christmas.
Exactly.
So tell us a little bit, what can we expect in the next issue? We've got a beautiful, and I'm a sucker for a donkey. It's got the most lovely donkey on the front cover. He doesn't look like he's a Swiss donkey. But
no, it's an Argentinian donkey, and it's the first cover that we don't show a wine image. We traveled to Argentina to the highest vineyard Actually, it's not the highest anymore. There's one in Tibet now that is, I think, 200 meters higher. We went to the Swiss-owned winery from Donald Test, Colomé, and the vineyards are on almost 3,200 meters. So, you know, I was a little bit scared to go so high and drink wine because, you know, you get fast drunk and there's not so much oxygen. So I went there slowly. I took some time. But on the way there, it's first of all, it's far, far away. You see more donkeys, you see more deserts, you see nothing that has to do with wine. And suddenly there is this plateau. And they planted there with some pioneer energy vineyards, and now they do fantastic wines.
It looks absolutely beautiful. The magazine itself has been going for a couple of years.
It's the fourth year now. I'm very, very proud. We started with nothing, and we created the new wine magazine that talks and looks at the topic a little bit different. So you don't need to be an expert to understand it. I want to show the more artistic part of wine, the more maybe also literature part of wine, and that you can enjoy wine without knowing all the technical details, because sometimes they're a little bit strange.
Yeah, and as you know, and we've discussed this before, that of course the world of wine can be like the world of art. It can be sort of rarefied, and
exactly.
And people disappear up themselves, etc. And as there's something, as you said, there's an honesty about this cover as well that sort of welcomes you in. You'd sort of probably like to sort of have a chat with this donkey,
exactly.
After a couple of bottles of these. Tell us a little bit about this bodega, though. That at this altitude, is there something different that you achieve with grapes grown at over 3,000 meters?
Of course, and it's something actually that will become more and more important because we have a global warming, the climate is changing. So some vineyards that are, let's say, in lower altitude, they first of all, don't have enough water, or the sunshine is not the best one. So a lot of wine growers, they start to plant now higher. So you have cooler nights, you have a different contact with the sunshine. And this is, of course, a topic for the future. And there they started to plant the grape that are specific for Argentina, which is the Malbec, and Torontes for the white, Malbec for the red. And the results are really fantastic. And it's a signature of its own, which defines also a country. It's nice when you have per country different styles and not the global style, which is also happening. But I think this Bodega Colomé does really nice work.
And is that for the export market?
They export a lot. Main market is America also and Europe.
John, just to when we look at Swiss wine and we talk about it, it's as we know, it's tricky to find. This country consumes obviously most of what it produces, which of course is a very nice thing. But as by way of a bit of update, is there sort of progress and more sort of willingness to get Swiss wine out in the world more than before?
I don't think so. I think Switzerland.
Bad news for people who want a stocking stuffer, but anyway.
No, I must say, in all these years, I travel now for this topic and I study this topic. You must say there's a uniqueness about Switzerland, which they are stubborn. You know, they have, there's a way and the way doesn't change. And it also works like this because, like you said, Tyler, the consumption in the country is 95 or 98% of the wine is consumed in the country. And I think if you export some wine, it should be only the best wine that will end up in wine restaurants on good wine lists, where you can, when a sommelier has to sell you the wine, because otherwise most of the people don't know that Switzerland has a very nice wine culture. So if you want to drink our wine, you have to come here. There's enough, you know, that we produce. We also drink a lot and we import a lot. So it's a very diverse wine country.
Is that where you're back, Georgina?
Absolutely. Well, you know, because Chandra was at the...
Well, Chandra comes to you as well.
Exactly.
I mean, which is
she
great,
was in London last week. And I have to say, plied us with Swiss wine. We were really quite happy about everything. We didn't mind the rain or anything by the end. But Chandra, you've written, I think, more than 20 books about wine, but including this wonderful journal that you do every year, talking about the core wines of Switzerland. Does that change much year to year?
You know, this is the difficulty. You want to change or to bring all the time new wines or new topics, and it's not obvious because especially in Switzerland a lot of things stay the same, which has also a beauty because you can rely on it, you find what you like. But let's say you have all the time like 30% changes, but not half of it is changing.
Just before we go, I think we probably have about 40 seconds left. three recommendations. They don't have to be Swiss, but if you wanted to put something with the roast beef around the table, maybe a nice little white to get things going, and maybe something sparkling, what would you recommend?
Okay, so with the white, you go with the Swiss wine. You can take or a specialty like Haida or even a fondant, a good chasselas. With the roast beef, you know, you go to France or to California, take a good Cabernet Sauvignon, a Bordeaux or a Cabernet. And the sparkling, you know, I love champagne, and I think champagne is always good.
Is there anything for Turkey?
Turkey, you go Burgundy. You got a good Pinot Noir, so you can have from the Grison from Switzerland, or you find a nice Burgundy wine from Burgundy.
And I just wonder, before we go, Chandra, is Turkey a seasonal delight here in Switzerland? I mean, in Britain, we would automatically have turkey at Christmas. Does that happen here?
Yeah, more and more. And I cook turkey on Christmas. Just usually you can also do like a big chicken, but turkey becomes more and more popular.
And you would have red with that?
I have Burgundy, yes.
Yeah. Tyler?
We go for more of a Nordic Christmas theme. So it's a bit more of an Estonian Christmas on the 24th. And then usually it's like something beefy. There's something, maybe like a, I don't know, like a nice fillet is on the barbecue. Which,
nice.
Will be fired up in Südtirol in a few weeks.
And you'd have a red with that, presumably.
I think so. Something nice from Südtirol.
Yeah.
Something from Lageder, maybe.
Would be good. Chandra, I'm so sorry that we haven't drunk here and that you haven't bought the drinks.
I'm sorry, I don't have a bottle with me.
I think that this is my opportunity now. We're about to finish the program. Can I buy you a drink?
I would love to. It's about time.
Yeah,
let's have a white wine.
We can do that right after this.
Absolutely. Chandra Kurt, thank you very much indeed.
And that's all we have time for this edition of The Stack. It's always sort of been a delight, of course, to be around the table. Today's show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our editors, George McDonough and David Stevens.
I'm Georgina Godwin, and
I'm Tyler Brulé.
Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.